Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Catherine May and welcome to The Wintering Sessions, the podcast that sets out to learn from the times when life is frozen. This week I'm talking to Michelle Adams, author of Little Wishes, Between the Lies and My Sister, who talks about the terrifying ways that life can suddenly change and how vital your support network becomes in those times. Right, should we start? We might as well just jump in, don't we?
Lovely to talk to you again.
Yeah, great to talk to you. So we actually, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because we recorded your podcast the other way around last week. So now the tables are turned, Michelle.
I've become the interviewee.
I know, is it scary?
it's actually a lot easier.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Much easier to be the interview and any sort of podcast that I did over publication week. It's just so easy. There's no preparation involved. You don't have to worry about post-production. You just log in, have a chat, and that's it. But being the host is a lot more effort. So thank you very much for inviting me.
I think podcasts are like my favourite kind of publicity to do. I've been doing loads for my book lately.
Yes.
And don't you just love podcasts? They are so relaxing. You just have a chat.
Yeah, it's really easy. And you don't think over what you're saying in the same way. So like if you're doing a written interview, you'll go over that paragraph, you know, maybe four or five times to make sure that you've not written a typo or that you've not said something incorrect. Whereas just having a chat with someone, it comes out so much more naturally. Somebody wanted to do an interview last week and said, shall I send you the questions or do you want to just have a chat on video all the way?
I know. The way that I agonise over written interviews is just hilarious. Yeah. You feel like you've got to say something profound.
Absolutely. And every little paragraph has to sort of be introduced and surmised in sort of an appropriate arc, as if it's very deep.
It's just a special way of torturing writers, I think.
Absolutely, definitely.
Pushes all our buttons. Right. So, well, let's talk about the wintering period in your life that you proposed to me, actually, because I thought that maybe we'd talk about the lovely essay you wrote for The Best Most Awful Job, which was the anthology I edited about motherhood last year.
Yes.
But you said, no, I've got something I really want to talk about. And I think probably it's quite relevant to what a lot of people have been going through this year, in that it was a very sudden illness, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, when we broached the idea of me talking about a wintering session in my life, I think a lot of people assume that the adoption process feels like that. And I suppose there are elements of it that are difficult, but I can't really describe it as a wintering period. It wasn't immensely difficult. It was challenging to wait and it was difficult, but I wouldn't say that I found it painful. Whereas the topic that I suggested talking about when I was ill very suddenly, that was absolutely how I would see a wintering period.
That's really interesting. So like, set this up for me. How, I mean, obviously I was going to say what happened, but but actually the what were you doing on the day that you suddenly fell ill?
Well, what I was doing on the day was visiting a friend, but it's worth going back a few weeks before that to start with, because I had been going through in Cyprus, as when you move into a different place, you're suddenly exposed to all sorts of different things that you're not exposed to in your home country. And the one thing that really sort of struck me quite hard when I moved to Cyprus is the allergy season, because there were suddenly all sorts of things that I was exposed to that I hadn't had a problem with before.
Right.
So I was going through, I think it was March time, a really bad allergy season where I had a lot of sinusitis. I couldn't breathe properly. And I'd been to see an ENT specialist and they'd prescribed some steroids as a spray in my nose, which is a very standard thing. And it hadn't particularly helped. I still had really bad sinusitis. And I also have a broken nose, which I don't know how I did, but we discovered that at the time. And there was some sort of theory that perhaps an operation to strain it up would be a good idea. And so we were going through this sort of steroid treatment as a spray in order to try to get to the point where we could potentially operate. And 3 weeks after taking the steroid spray, I woke up very early one morning with intense pain in my head and in my eye, which I don't really know whether it was associated, but in hindsight, I think that it was. And it was, I guess, what a lot of people would describe as a cluster headache. I was on the floor. I've never really had migraines, so I don't really know what that's like, but I was on the floor. I couldn't move. I was being sick. I had a pain in my eye. I ended up going to the hospital and having some morphine, and that cleared it. They said, okay, you've probably got really bad sinusitis still, and that's affected it. And we need to just sort of up the ante a little bit with what medication we're giving to you. And so they started me on a series of oral steroids, which I took for 5 days. And on day five, I was ill. I was going to a baby shower along with my stepdaughter, who was about, I think she was probably about seven at the time. And we traveled in the car for around about sort of 45 minutes to an hour. And I dropped her off at my friend's house in order to go and then see another friend very briefly for a quick coffee, because I hadn't seen her for a long time. And when I got out of the car at the cafe, my foot was numb. And it was sort of like, you know, if you've been driving on a motorway for a long time and your foot goes to sleep. I got out of the car and laughed to myself, like, oh my God, I got so pathetic since I've moved to Cyprus. You know, I used to be able to drive 4 hours on the M6 and it was fine. I can't drive for an hour and my foot's numb. Went into the cafe, ordered my drink, went and sat down at the table. And when I came to pick up my coffee, I realized that my fingers were numb as well. And I thought, that doesn't seem very good. And slowly over, I think it was probably about 20, 30 minutes, the numb foot began in my fingers and then my arm. And slowly the whole right side of my body just became very numb and I became very confused. And my friend said to me, are you okay? You know, you don't look very well. Do you want me to call your husband? He was my fiance at the time. And I said, no, don't call him. And I don't know why in my head I thought that this was a good idea, but I think I realized that there was something wrong with me. And I just said, no, I'm going to be okay. I'm just going to get home, which was a really bad idea because it was like an hour's drive.
Oh, gosh, you drove yourself home.
In my head, I was thinking, I need to get home because there's something not right here. But within sort of, you know, a few more minutes, it became evident that there was no chance of that happening. And she said, I'm going to call Stasinos, your husband. And by the time that I spoke to him on the telephone, he asked me, you know, what's wrong with you? And I said, I don't know. And he said, can you tell me where you live? And it was the first question where I realized I couldn't give the answer. I didn't know where I was and I couldn't say what my name was.
Oh my goodness. Do you remember now him asking you that question, or is that something that you know?
I do. I remember at that point. I remember also it was a really weird thing because I realized that I couldn't give the answer, but I was also conscious of the fact that I couldn't give the answer. So there wasn't, I wasn't confused about it. I realized I can't give him really simple information about myself. And that in itself was very scary because sort of internally, I still felt very conscious of what was going on. Although in hindsight, probably I wasn't because I don't remember very much after it. But at that time, I remember him saying, can you tell me your name and where you live? And I couldn't do that.
Wow. Wow. So what happened after that?
Well, because I was in a different city, I went to the local hospital there with my friend and my husband started coming from the city that we live in. But in the meantime, he asked his brother, who lives in that city where I was visiting, to go to the hospital because I wasn't well. And I don't know when he arrived, but he must have arrived some 15 or 20 minutes later. And I remember seeing his face and him looking at me. And I sort of realized, oh, I'm really like this. I don't look well. And then I became aware that there was sort of a heaviness on the right side of my face. And I had been working in the NHS before that for about 12 years in cardiology. And so although I wasn't involved in directly with the sort of the patients who had strokes and things, we did have like quite a close link with that ward. And I remember thinking my face has got a weakness to it. And that was the time then I thought I'm having a stroke.
How old were you?
I must have been 32, 33.
Yeah. So that's not the age you expect to be having a stroke in general.
It's not. It's not the age you expect to have a stroke. And I had no risk factors for having a stroke, but I was aware that I'd seen people, you know, all through my working life with these weak, droopy faces, but never anticipated that that would be something that you could actually feel. I could feel my face had sort of fallen and I kept touching it and I could feel that my lips had dropped and that my eye had dropped. And after that, I don't remember anything with much clarity. I remember my husband being there at some point and asking questions. I remember them being upset in the beginning. They tried to say that I was either having a panic attack or that I had taken some sort of drug, which neither were true.
Yeah, yeah.
And my husband's a doctor. And so when he arrived, he immediately sort of tried to go into work mode, which is not very easy, I think, when you're sort of emotionally very charged by somebody that you love being ill. But because they seemed to be focused on the fact that I was just a, you know, silly young girl having a panic attack and that it didn't need to be taken very seriously, he found one of his colleagues who then got neurology involved, and they very quickly sort of escalated things. And they made the decision that either I was having a stroke or I had some sort of compression from a tumor that had happened very acutely, or there was some sort of hemorrhage or something going on. And they were planning to prep for surgery. That was the sort of, that was the idea. And in the meantime, they needed to do things like a lumbar puncture, an MRI. I think I had a CT angiogram. And this is all across sort of like, I think about 10 or 12 hours.
My goodness.
Until around midnight. And at midnight, the results all came back and there was nothing wrong with me. They couldn't find anything wrong with me. So I ended up then, by that point, I'd sort of, my heart rate had been dropping. And so they'd intubated me and I was going to the intensive care unit on a ventilator. But nobody had any clue what was wrong with me. I just couldn't tell you who I was. I looked like I was having a stroke, but there was no evidence of anything.
Gosh, that's just terrifying. And like the speed at which that's all happening and you're at the centre of this flurry of medical activity, you must have been so grateful for your husband and his knowledge. I mean, what would have happened to you without it?
Well, I wasn't at the time because obviously I didn't really have much of a clue what was happening. But I do remember sort of flashes of the day. I remember my sister-in-law being there and her of trying to be really, really reassuring. I remember my friend being there and being really upset. And I sort of remember my husband being there on and off. And I remember at one point being angry with him, like, where is he? Like, what's he doing? But actually, you know, he was running around trying to get stuff organized and get things moving. But by the end of the day, you know, he was sort of in a bit of a mess, really, because as a doctor, I think you always looking to answer a question. And the question was, what's happened to Michelle? And nobody knew what had happened to me. And by that point, I'd exhibited really strange behaviours as well. You know, like I had, I had tried to bite the doctor at one point. They tried to hold me down in order to do CT, and I just fought like crazy. And the next day, the doctor who had sort of taken charge, he said to me, "If this was a few hundred years ago, we'd have burnt you at the stake. You were not behaving in the way that we wanted you to."
But presumably, I mean, you know, even if you don't remember it, some kind of like survival instincts kicking in, and you're fighting for your life. You know, you don't know what these people are up to.
Yeah, I remember being intensely scared. And one of the thoughts that kept running through my head was that I'm having a stroke, and after this, I might not be able to walk again. And I'm getting married in 3 months. Like, I'm not going to be able to walk down the aisle. And that became very important to me at the time. But there came a point at some point during the evening before they anaesthetized me that I'd sort of given up. I was exhausted and I was flat and I didn't have any energy left for anything.
I'm really fascinated by the state of mind that happens at those most desperate moments of ill health. I mean, because I collapsed with sunstroke once, and I can really I actually can remember the kind of clarity before I kind of lost consciousness.
Yeah.
I remember like this moment of sinking towards the ground very slowly, thinking,
yeah,
oh, I can't stay upright. You know, it's quite a peculiar. And my husband was assaulted when he was 18 by a group of lads with fence posts, hit him around the head with, he was very badly beaten. And he remembers this moment, again, before he lost consciousness, of kind of complete clarity of thinking, right, I've got to lay still because then they'll think I'm dead.
Yeah.
But he also remembers this moment of intense kind of regret for not having lived his life yet. And you know, there's this kind of crystalline clarity there, even though there's a lack of command between your mind and your body almost.
Yeah.
Interesting to hear you talk about it too. There's some sort of common response there that it's hard to understand from the outside, really, I think.
Yeah, I think in a moment like that, irrespective of whatever illness it is or whatever incident has happened, like your husband and you experienced as well, I think sort of it's almost like all of your other concerns just disappear, and the only thing that matters is the exact thing that's happening at that moment.
Yeah. We'll be back with more from Michelle Adams in a moment, but I just wanted to let you know that I'll be releasing some new dates for my writing courses soon, as well as some brand new online workshops for people who want to explore the concept of wintering a little more. If you'd like to be the first to know, go to katherine-may.com/newsletters and click the link that's right for you. I promise not to spam you, and I'll keep your information safe. And now back to Michelle Adams. So, wow. I mean, presumably you just woke up again at some point.
Yeah, I woke up the following day, 7 or 8 hours after I'd arrived on the intensive care unit. And I woke up without much of a knowledge of where I was or what had happened the day before.
Yeah.
And so my first thought when I woke up was, where am I and what's going on? And I started to sort of investigate. I very quickly realized that I was in a hospital, and I found that I'd got wires on my chest from ECG electrodes. And then I moved down further and further and further to the point when I realized I'd been catheterized. And at which point I just became absolutely livid, because in my head I was saying to myself, I'm 32, 33 years old, and they've catheterized me. That's like what you do for an old lady. And I flung the sheets off me. I tried to pull the catheter out. I tried to get out of bed, at which point, obviously, the nurses then obviously don't come back and settle me back down.
You had form by then.
I had form. And so they settled me back down, and I went back to sleep. But this went on and on and on all morning. Every time I woke up, I was going through the same thing. I'm like, catheterized, and I try and pull it out, and I try and get out of bed again. But at some point, I remember my husband arriving, and he said, "My family are here, and they want to see you. But Michelle, you're naked. You've got to stay under the sheets." And it was the first moment of clarity that I thought, right, this is my father-in-law coming in now. I really need to like stay under the sheets. And that was a sort of reassuring moment that, okay, I'm back a little bit now. I know that this is not appropriate, and I can start to sort of control my behavior again. And after a time, they they sent me back to the ward. And I was in hospital for about 5 or 6 days, I think. And all through that period, they'd been giving me intravenous antibiotics because they still didn't really know what was wrong with me. And I think that they were concerned that I'd had some sort of like viral meningitis. They didn't really have a definitive diagnosis other than, you know, sort of a presentation of what I had shown them, which was that I had, for a time, had neurological symptoms and had appeared psychotic. That was all they could tell me. And they didn't know whether it was, you know, a virus, an encephalopathy. They had no clue. But slowly over the 5 days, it was a slow process, but slowly by sort of 5 days, I could understand that I was myself again. I wasn't confused in the way that I had been in the immediate days after the incident, and they let me go home.
And that's the most you ever knew about it. So did you ever get to the bottom of what had happened?
Well, we got to what is probably the most likely diagnosis, is that I had a seizure as a result of a reaction to the medicine. That's what they think. And that was shown by the one thing that seemed to be abnormal after it all was that I had changes in my EEG, which is the scan that they do with the little electrodes on your head to get your brain waveforms. And they found some sort of change characteristic with like post-seizure activity. And then I had a repeat test of that for, I think, four weeks later, which showed that those changes were resolving. So something had happened and was going back to normal.
Yeah.
But it was more then about sort of how it had affected us both in sort of the recovery. We'd gone from both being sort of quite confident and easygoing people to two completely different people. My husband, Stasinos, was just sort of constantly alert to anything that I said. If I said I had a headache, it was difficult. You know, he was sort of watching me with a hawk's eye, looking for changes. He was constantly looking at my eyes, whether one was drooping, whether one wasn't drooping, whether I was squinting, which I found very hard to deal with because it was like I was under
surveillance
all the time.
Yeah.
But also my entire personality changed. I became very anxious and scared. We had an office that we worked from, which was about 10 minutes from our apartment where we used to live. And the normal state of affairs is that I'd just walk to work and walk back from work. And obviously after this, once I ended up back at work, he was driving us there and back. And one day he couldn't come back to pick me up, and I sort of burst into floods of tears, and I couldn't bring myself to go home. Like, what's going to happen? And it was just, I was so scared that something was going to happen to me being on my own, that it was sort of, it really sort of rippled through our life for the next 3 or 4 months. And even after that, in like a very sort of minor way, we still refer to it as sort of like the day that was really difficult.
And so do you think there's been any kind of permanent effects of that? Did it change you in general, or do you think actually you sort of settled down after a while?
I think for me, I don't think I have been permanently bothered by it because I don't remember a lot of it. In the first few months, I was very bothered by it, and I was aware that it had been a lot more stressful for me than perhaps even I anticipated, because when I went to get my hair cut, they found that a huge patch at the back of my head had fallen out.
Oh no.
Which must have happened on the day, but you know, I have no recollection of it, obviously. It's just, it happened through the stress of what was going on. But I think probably affected more the people around me. I think that my husband found it much harder to move on from the experience than I did.
Yeah, because he'd been there and sort of watched it all unfold. And that's scary, isn't it? When you see someone you love being really ill.
I think to witness it was much harder in the long term than it was to go through it.
Did any useful things come out of it? You know, I talked to someone the other week who talked about an illness, and it gave them a kind of sense of resolve about how short life might be. Did it have that effect on you?
It didn't, I don't think. I don't think that I took that away with me. What I did do in the months afterwards, I found that I wanted to try to process it. And so I did then what I do for anything I want to process, which is to write about it. And I wrote a book that was not published by a publisher, which was all about the experience of a person sort of losing their mind and not knowing what happened to them and having sort of blanks in their almost like fugue states. And I put a lot of my feelings into that book. And that certainly really helped me process it and move on. And I think sort of finishing that book, really, that was my, like, I'm drawing a line under this now. It's happened. We've experienced it. And I now can look back on it with some degree of humor. For example, I think it was the day after that I'd been taken out from the intensive care unit and put on the normal ward. I was in a side room with the little toilet. And in the middle of the night, I got up, wheeled myself in there with my little drip stand. And a couple of minutes later, somebody's knocking the door. And this is all obviously also in my second language, which is another thing. I couldn't speak English when I came round, which is really bizarre because at the time I couldn't speak Greek that well either. But this lady said to me, "Where are you?" when I was in the bathroom. "Where are you?" And I said, "What do you mean, where am I? I'm in the toilet." And she said, "No, where are you?" And I sat there on the toilet thinking, what's wrong with her? Like, has she lost her mind? Like, I just told her I'm in the toilet. And obviously, like, what she was asking was, do you know where you are? Do you know that you're in the hospital? It was sort of a moment of realization. Oh, yeah, I'm the one that's been diagnosed as psychotic here. Like, they want to know that I'm okay, not me questioning whether they know what they're talking about. I look back at it in a humorous way now, but my husband, even sort of 7-8 years later, he's still not quite there.
No, which is really, really understandable. I would love to talk about the book that you wrote afterwards, just because I'm really fascinated by writers' apprentice pieces that they write before they publish. I think that people who are trying to be writers don't realise how many of us have got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 books that we wrote before anyone agreed to publish us. And that was our training ground, maybe?
Yeah, totally. My first book that was released by a publisher was called My Sister. But before that, I'd written 6 other books. So My Sister was the first one that got picked up by an agent. The first one I had written was about 5 years before I got an agent, I think. And I had sort of written it. It was about 75,000 words. I was very happy that I'd written a book, very celebratory, and had no idea what it meant to edit a book. And so I very happily finished my draft and sent it off to agents and was rejected, 1,000 times. And couldn't understand why. I thought all you need to do is write a book. Of course, I finished it. Why don't they want it? Ridiculous.
It's like, guys, I have written a book.
This has taken me 4 months to write this book. But I realized, after that, it needed more work. And so I just focused on writing another book and trying to sort of hone my craft. And I didn't try to get an agent after that. I don't know whether that was because I was burnt from the experience of not getting one the first time, or whether it was because I'd emigrated. And back then it was sort of, must have been 2011. It wasn't quite as easy to submit by email. Everything was letter.
Right.
And I thought it's going to be too difficult from here. Maybe that ship has sailed. But I had written after that, I'd written the 6 books in before My Sister. And it wasn't until I'd written My Sister that I sort of looked at it. I was ready to go self-publishing. All of my books were self-published until then. So I was ready to go with it again. I had a cover written, a cover made up. It was called Firstborn. I was ready to hit publish. And I happened to have a conversation with another aspiring writer, for want of a better word, and said, I'm going to start looking for an agent. And I sort of sat back and thought, why am I not buying anymore? And so then I set about trying to find an agent, and was very fortunate to find representation and a subsequent deal.
That's really, I think it's just such a good story to tell, because I think very few people realize the sheer length of time that loads of us work on being writers before like anything happens at all, and how, like, what resilience you need to keep going because you want to write and not for, not because anyone's paying you any damned attention.
But the attention also is really nice. Like when you're first writing and someone says something nice about your work, it feels really good. And that's so sort of inspiring. It was to me anyway. That's why I started self-publishing, because I thought, if I can't get an agent, then that's fair enough. But that doesn't mean that what I'm writing is necessarily rubbish, and maybe somebody would enjoy it. So I started putting them on Amazon, and I took it very seriously. I mean, at one point I had no intention of trying to find an agent. I had a designer, she did my covers for me, found an editor and was working to try to make my work better. And I was really enjoying the whole process of like trying to sort of do it myself. So I think the whole area of self-publishing, like it used to have sort of a,
oh my goodness, it's, yeah,
a bad name, but I don't think that's the case anymore. And I really think anyone who's writing, even if you want to find an agent at some point, even if you haven't found an agent at the stage that you're at, then the joy of having your book out there and in people's hands is really something that's really inspiring. Is perhaps
it's so valuable.
It's valuable. It's encouraging is what I'm looking for. It's
really affirming.
Affirming. Having someone say, oh, I read your book and I really liked it. Thanks very much. And that felt really, really good for me. And actually, the book that I'm referring to about this experience, it was called Psychophilia. And
good name.
Yeah. my husband came up with that. So somebody wrote to me after that saying that it had literally sort of described their experiences with mental health. And that felt really good as well, that I had connected with somebody else who'd been through something.
Yeah, that connection is amazing. And I do think that actually so much of like mainstream traditional publishing is almost designed to have the writer in a passive state. It used to be that we were being coddled by the publishing industry. And I don't think that's true anymore. I don't think we're kind of coddled, but I think that there's like a passivity that remains. And I've always found that quite uncomfortable, you know, like you cannot take control of your own destiny. And I totally respect and admire the people that manage to self-publish, because I think it takes a particular skill set to get it right and to actually sell books in that environment. But I think, like, why wouldn't you, you know?
I think so. And I think when people start, they don't necessarily know what they're doing with any great sort of clarity. And I think that's the same as I wrote my first book and I sent it to an agent and it wasn't good enough. But it didn't mean that I couldn't try to do something with it. And I used that book as a learning curve. And there's no doubt that the books that I self-published towards the end of my self-publishing period, they looked better. They were more professionally finished. The stories were better resolved. I think that there's a lot to be said for that in the terms of becoming a good writer.
And I think actually that readers often demand different things from books than publishing professionals do. In fact, I think that's an insight that the huge success of self-publishing has given us, is like how much readers love just being able to immerse themselves in genre and having a steady supply of the kind of books that they like. They're not picking up on the same stuff as people within the publishing industry are, I don't think.
And there's also a very fast route to market. So if you're a fast writer and you've written, I know a lot of people who traditionally publish and they've written their book in, 28 days.
Yes, I know.
Besides the editing. But if you can write your book in 28 days and you're committed to editing that book, from like the conception of the idea to having the book on Amazon and available to readers, you can have sort of 3 or 4 months and that's it.
Yeah.
And if you're doing that all the time, then you've got a high turnover rate and you get good visibility on the platform and people have access to your work.
And a direct route to those readers, you know, who talk to you and say lovely things.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is very encouraging when you're actually trying to find a reason to keep writing in the face of rejection.
Absolutely. Amazing. Oh, well, look, I just have loved talking to you today. That was such a fascinating story. I'm so glad you're so well now, and I hope it never happens again.
Yes.
But I thought it was just wonderful delving into that mind state that you were in at that time. I think that's just brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you. So your most recent book, tell me about it, because I was just about to summarize it and that would be a bad thing to do. So I'm going to frame that to say, so tell us all about your most recent book.
Well, my most recent book, I have verged away from thrillers at the moment, and I wrote a women's fiction novel, which is about a young couple in the late 60s in a small village in Cornwall, where Elizabeth is the daughter of the local doctor, and her family have a lot of aspirations for her future, who she's going to marry and what kind of life she's going to lead. But she happens to fall in love with a local boy who doesn't have the same aspirations and who doesn't come from the kind of family that they would have hoped her future husband came from. And irrespective of their family's feelings about this, they do fall in love and are seriously committed to forging a life together. But at the last minute, when they're set to tell their families that they're together, there's a tragedy in that Elizabeth's mother dies in a horrible accident. And there are a lot of things said at the time between the two families, which drive a wedge between the two young lovers.
Mm.
And they then end up on trajectories where their life takes different courses. Irrespective of that, though, their love doesn't ever die. And Tom, every year, returns to deliver a small gift in the shape of a blue flower, which is what he did for her on the day when they first kissed and declared their love to each other. And every year, this flower has a wish attached to it, and it's a wish for what they would be doing if they were together. And on the 50th year, Elizabeth opens the door expecting to find this little wish on her doorstep and realizes that it's not there. And in a panic about what might have happened to Tom now that they're elderly, she searches for him, knowing where he was all along. And it's about their reunion and the secrets that kept them apart and about trying to have a second chance at first love.
Mm. And who'd have known you're such a romantic soul given the darkness of your previous work? I love that.
It's quite a shift in genre. It really is.
And how does it feel to shift genre like that? Is there one that you prefer writing now? Or do you feel like you're indulging both sides of your character?
I think I'm definitely indulging both sides of my character. I decided that I'd like to write this book. Even before one of my first thrillers had been published. My first two thrillers had been sold. And then we had a sort of a family thing where my father was diagnosed with lung cancer. And he died, I think it was no more than sort of 7 or 8 weeks after his diagnosis.
Oh, wow.
And it was a bit of a sort of shocking time for us because it had been completely unanticipated. But my experience of that time and watching him with his partner and sort of how they loved each other, even like right up until the last moments of his life, she was just there all the time, looking after him and caring for him. It really sort of inspired me that I had a story that I wanted to tell in that. And it wasn't necessarily just about the sort of the bleakness of having somebody die in your family who has cancer, but more about focusing on the fact that even when there's no hope for anything more, you can still love somebody. And that's perhaps sort of the most pure form of love that there is, when there is nothing to gain from it, but you love somebody anyway. And so I approached Maddie, our agent, and I said, look, I have this idea for a love story. I'm sorry that my thrillers haven't been published yet, but what do you think? And, and she was really positive about it. I think that's one of the things that we're lucky about with the person that represents us, is that she's very keen to represent your entirety as a writer rather than just sort of follow you for one book and hope that it does well.
Yeah.
And so I was very supported by her in writing this book. So I finished my contracts with the thrillers, and when I had a period of time when I had the space to do so, I then explored this women's fiction book, which has been a real joy, actually. I mean, it was a joy because it sort of involved my father, who we'd lost very suddenly, and it was a nice opportunity to sort of explore my feelings about him and the thing that we'd been through as a family. But also, it was just really nice to write this really, I mean, it is a sad story, but I think it's one where it's hopeful and the focus is more on the fact that people love each other and they're trying to solve their problems rather than the dark elements we so associate with thrillers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was a really nice experience, actually.
And of course, we writers are not really just one personality, you know, like the idea that there's one kind of genre that we can only write is a complete fallacy, really. I think we're all passionate about loads of different things.
Yeah.
It's really, and sometimes it's hard to break out. And it's lovely to see that you have, you know, been able to expand out into more options.
I think that's also one of the really positive things about, if you don't have an agent, trying self-publishing, because you get to do anything and you get to explore different genres and what you like. And one of the few things I hadn't explored as a self-publisher was women's fiction. So yeah, it was really nice to explore that with my agent.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, Michelle, it's been an absolute joy to speak to you. Thank you so much. And I will make sure that all the links to your books and contacts are in the show notes so that people can look you up.
Thank you so much, Catherine. It's lovely to talk to you.
And that's all from us today. Thank you so much to Michelle Adams for sharing such a vulnerable moment with us. Little Wishes is available in all good bookstores, and you can keep up with Michelle's news on Instagram or Twitter. Links are in the show notes. I'll be back next week with another brilliant writer who is intimate with winter. Thanks for listening. The Wintering Sessions is produced by Buddy Peace, who also composed the original title music. You can buy Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times, in all good bookshops.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.